Thanks, Roger. Thanks for inviting me. I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to this meeting, giving me a chance to talk about some work you can see here. I've been working on this, my own interest in machine learning since back in 2010. I guess I'm the first, I hope not the last speaker, who will talk about reinforcement learning. So you heard earlier about supervised learning and unsupervised learning, but there are other types of machine learning. I didn't put it in the title, but I'll explain a bit about reinforcement learning. My work is using machine learning for quantum purposes, quantum gate design, quantum metrology, those kinds of things. So I'm not using, it's not quantum machine learning, but it's machine learning for doing quantum things. So the work, we first started with this ITNG proceeding back in 2010. There's some other papers at PRA. This is ESAN, the European Symposium on Artificial Neural Networks. So we had a paper there. We're writing up something for neurocomputing. So we're trying to make sure that our work is solidly accepted by the neurocomputing community. And then here's a number of other papers. We haven't written a good long paper. So actually giving this talk is giving me a chance to think about how we can write a proper paper that can be read, not PRLs that are 4 pages with supplementary. And then this, I just wanted to make sure, yeah, University of Calgary, Josh, so the AV is there. I'm also a part-time 1,000 talent chair at the University of Science and Technology of China, so I'm there 10 weeks a year, split between Hefei and Shanghai, funding agencies, and I'm also with the New Journal of Physics, so I thought I'd mention that. Okay, here's the breakdown. Oh, that's Calgary and Shanghai, the 2 cities I live in. Here's the breakdown. I'll just give you an introduction, including reinforcement learning, the problem I deal with, claims, and then we'll deal with the quantum metrology application, we'll deal with the quantum control application, and then I'll tell you our current favorite approach, which is differential evolution. I'll talk about that and how we modified it to deliver results. Just to give you the ideas that we're trying to deal with controlling quantum systems, and we have we can have a couple of hundred dimensional search spaces with constraints that can be more than a couple of hundred dimensions. And differential evolution is a way of a reinforcement learning technique that works really well for those kinds of spaces. And then I'll conclude. Oh, and I'm very social media active, so I thought I'd start. First talk I'm giving like that, so I thought I would just list all the stuff. Okay, so let's just go straight to the problem. I've tried to define it concisely and well, and you're welcome to interrupt at any time if anything's not clear, or even if it is clear, you're welcome to interrupt and say that was clear. So the idea here, the problem is, and I'll explain the terms, to develop policies to control quantum dynamics subject to constraints. And this is very important that in a lot of control problems, the constraints are not so significant. And the way that you think about it is how big is your search space to control and how many constraints are there. It's a good rule of thumb. And for things like quantum gate design, quantum metrology, et cetera, the kind of things that we do in quantum systems tend to be much more constrained than they are in non-quantum systems. But actually, I'll point out that reinforcement learning is now used quite a lot in engineering for control schemes. But within the quantum community, the tendency is to work with what are greedy algorithms, and I'll explain it. So I'm interested in cases when greedy algorithms fail. Our techniques, our approach, computationally, our systems can simulate like 10,000 times worse. So sometimes people wonder, why are we developing these methods where we get a solution 10,000 times slower than another? And the answer is because we're interested in the cases where the fast technique fails. The black dot ones here are the two applications I'll talk about, quantum gate design, adaptive quantum metrology. The hollow dots refer to other areas that I think about, but I won't talk about here. And the green boxes tell you just, they're to give some background because, you know, everybody comes from different background. So control, I just wanted to make sure you know what it is. And control is really that you have a system with parameters that are somehow you can adjust with knobs in the laboratory. And they can be dynamically changed. So you can turn knobs during the run of the experiment. And the idea of doing a control is to make sure that your system will follow some desired trajectory. So if you have control on your washing machine, you want your clothes to come out clean but not with holes in them, you know. So the idea of control is there's a concept of what trajectory your system should follow. And I'm going to use the word policy a lot. Policy is used in machine learning where a lot of times we physicists might refer to procedures or sometimes even the word protocol. And so a policy is used in order to refer to a procedure whose purpose, so it's a procedure in the sense of being a set of instructions, and the purpose is to make sure with respect to how the machine operates, it's going to operate in a way that is optimal or desirable. So the idea is ultimately you'll see that we have to search policy space. So I think of policies, that set of procedures, as occupying a space, and I'll show you later how we turn policies into vector spaces, and then we use vector space properties to be able to do searches. So our claim is that we have heuristic-based reinforcement learning algorithms, and I claim that sometimes they work. Okay, so it's always a very cautious claim. I'm not claiming I have the answer to everything, but in cases that we study, we've been able to find cases where greedy algorithms, which I'll explain in a moment, don't work and ours do. And that's kind of the best you can do with machine learning. You can't guarantee a panacea for everything. Greedy algorithms, which are predominant in quantum research, are types. I did a couple of pictures here, hill climbing and quasi-Newton. Quasi-Newton makes use of gradients and Hessians. And so the idea of greedy algorithms is they aim to optimize, and they optimize by only looking at local conditions. So if you're trying to find a minimum, or let's say a maximum, and then you might climb up the hill. You might climb up the hill the steepest way. And if you know something about the Hessian or second derivatives, then you might know a little bit better how to climb. And the higher order derivatives come at higher cost. But the key point of greedy algorithms is they only exploit local conditions. And so they're great if your landscape, your fitness landscape, has very nice properties. We're going to be interested in cases with hundreds of dimensions and very nasty landscapes, including fractal properties, saddle points. But saddle points in high dimensions can form traps. And so in those cases, greedy algorithms, and one people here might know is GRAPE, gradient ascent pulse engineering, those techniques ultimately would fail. They work extremely well provided the constraints are low and the dimension is high. There's a paper by Herschel Rabbits in Science back in 2004 that makes an intuitive case for that. But there are cases where they don't work. So I'm interested in reinforcement learning. As I said, you've heard a bit about supervised and unsupervised learning, so I thought I would explain the reinforcement learning. We're interested in landscapes where you can see a saddle point here. You can see valleys and fractal regions. And this is not a made-up case. This is actually one of the landscapes that we deal with. So they really arise in our system, things like that. The idea of reinforcement learning is, so you know with supervised learning, the idea is that you might have a training set, and then you make use of the training set or existing knowledge to be able to do better. In reinforcement learning, you want to trade off exploitation and exploration. It's conceptually, it came in the multi-armed bandit problem, if anybody knows that one. And so the idea is that you have limited knowledge. It doesn't have to be local. It can be non-local. And this is a particle swarm optimization. My early papers use this. These birds are flying around a landscape. Each one has some knowledge about where it's been, but they can communicate. So in a collective intelligence model, it's not strictly local. You can have a multi-agent system that shares knowledge. But the idea is that there's an exploration. So they might know what is good from their past and what they share, but they also search for better conditions outside. And there's a trade-off between the two. And there's no training set. So there has to be a fitness function so that as the exploration goes further out to look for better solutions, there has to be a concept of better. And better is defined by a fitness parameter. The particle swarm optimization is a collective intelligence model, but in the past 3 years, we've dropped that entirely, and we're finding the differential evolution. So it's an evolutionary algorithm that doesn't look terribly different from genetic algorithms, but actually performs really, really well. It's one of the best out there for high-dimensional searches. So we've abandoned that, and we go for differential evolution, and I'll explain that. So here's the two cases that we want to deal with. One is adaptive phase estimation. It's a quantum metrology problem. And I'll show you in a moment, but it's related to atomic clocks, gravitational wave detection, things like that. So it's I'll deal with it on an abstract level, but it has potential implications for practical technologies. And the other one is I'll talk about quantum gate design, in particular making a 3-qubit gate. And this is motivated by the experiment that was done by Martinez's group at Santa Barbara before they went to Google. They had a big breakthrough about a year and a half ago with a very high fidelity CZ gate, control Z gate. And we're showing here how to push it from 2-qubit to 3-qubit gates. And actually, we just got a result a few days ago for 4-qubit gates. But it's not polished enough to present here. So let's now go into, we're into the quantum metrology part. So let me explain this particular application. And I don't want to dwell so much on the physics. It's more to give you an idea of how to convert these problems into reinforcement learning. So the idea of quantum enhanced metrology is what I'll call it, is that the quantum world has, you know, we can think on a first level about an uncertainty principle. And the uncertainty principle gives us a limit known as the standard quantum limit. And it says that if you want to estimate the phase of an unknown phase in an interferometer, your estimate, your precision, will grow only with the square root of the number of particles. They could be the atoms in an atomic clock or the photons used in a dual recycled Michelson interferometer for gravitational wave detection. So that's the problem. Then we have the case where we can make use of quantum resources, which can be manifested as entanglement or squeezing, where squeezing is a way of using, playing with your uncertainty principle so you can reduce uncertainty with respect to a collection of particles in one degree of freedom and increase in another. And if you do that, you can get a quadratic enhancement of the precision. So instead of your precision growing as the square root of number of particles, it grows linearly in the number of particles. And that can make a big difference as to whether an atomic clock or a gravitational wave can be observed, because the if you try to put too many photons in, you might burn out optical elements or something. So there's a good reason that a quadratic enhancement's interesting. Okay, so there's a couple of ways to proceed. We can think of the interferometer as being of this form that we just send in. Think of these as photons that go into a beam splitter. Each photon could go in one way or the other. Or you can think of an entangled state where, you know, you could have a superposition of all photons in one, all photons in the other. You could have some weird state going in such the output of the beam splitter is all going this way or all going that way. And that's the noon state that some people might have heard of. And so there are different ways to play with this. And then by doing it in the right way, you can get, for example, the noon state, get estimate that phase with a precision that's linear in the number of photons going in. The problem is that you have to measure everything coming out. So there's issues to do with dispersion and pulses and things that can matter. You can then instead think about restricting to one particle detection at a time. So you send in your photons. And imagine that each photon that goes through, it can come out one way or the other. And if it comes out one way or the other, imagine that you could prepare a known phase shift or a control system so that the next photon experiences a different phase shift. And through this scheme, you can also reach towards a one on n scaling of your delta phi, reach the quantum limit, reach towards it. And this becomes a control scheme. PU stands for processing unit. So it's just a way of taking the information, processing it back. And this shows you more abstractly how it goes. This would be an uncontrolled system. This becomes a controlled system where you tweak the parameter to extract more and more information smarter out of the system. And so this represents an adaptive quantum enhanced measurement. So here's the A for adaptive. And so this is the kind of scheme we want to consider. And now I want to show you how to convert it to a reinforcement learning problem. So here you can see that if the photon goes there or there, it feeds one bit of information into the processing unit. And the processing unit will adjust that phase according to one of two values depending on that bit of information. Next photon comes through, feeds in another bit, and so on. If we follow that procedure, here, I'm going to take the first photon going in. There's an arbitrary phase set over here. I'll explain that state in a moment. And I'm going to start building a decision tree. So when the second photon comes in, well, when the first photon went through, there's a detection of 0 or 1. So we construct the decision tree, and then we adjust the phase here depending on whether 0 or 1 were detected. Next photon goes through, we have another case, and then we just proceed until all the photons are used up, and the so-called leaves of the decision tree are used to infer that phase shift. So this is the way that we can convert a processing unit by discretizing in time, in a natural way here for the photons going through, into a decision tree. That decision tree, unfortunately, has if you search for the best decision tree, which will be our policy, there's an exponential number of possible values here. And that, of course, anything exponential is bad news in computing. So what we do in our system is we introduce heuristics. In this case, a generalized logarithmic search. So instead of allowing all different values, this decision tree is equivalent to saying, okay, after the first photon comes through, we'll make our phase go up or down pi on 2. The next one, we might make it go up or down pi on 4, might make it go up or down pi on 5, and then we search the space of how tightly or loosely that knob should be adjusted. You know, should it go from pi on 4 to pi on 5, or pi on 4 to pi on 6? Those kinds of things. So we can then search that decision tree, subject to the heuristic of this generalized logarithmic search, how we tune it. Then, so the idea of like making a knob have a phase adjustment that goes up by a factor of 2 every time, that's equivalent to the computer science algorithm of logarithmic search. So generalizing it just gives us that freedom. So if we do that, we can then start to figure out which decision tree or which policy would be the best. Here's the way we evaluate it. So again, we don't have a training set, so here's the way we think about it. We inject what sometimes called a sign state. The original work on this was done by Summy and Pegg back at Josh's alma mater, Griffith University. So you have a state that's almost equal number going in both ports, but there's some superposition of slightly more in one port and slightly less in the other. And then we feed in that state, we send it through, run our processing unit. That's the policy. So that row is just encoding these deltas that record the policy. And then we evaluate it. And we evaluate it according to a fitness function. We would like to use variances, but phase is periodic, so it's a little bit subtle. So we use a standard, very good approach to evaluating how fit it is. This is a sharpness function. So it tells us how sharp the phase estimate is for the unknown phase. And this quantity is known sometimes as the Halevo variance, which is you take that sharpness function, invert it, square it, subtract 1. And if the spread in phase is sufficiently small, it agrees with the variance of phase. It looks like variance if you don't feel the boundaries of minus pi to pi. When we do that, we can then take our vector. So our decision tree can be written as a vector, and our vector can be written as a vector space. And then you can verify that you can add decision trees, you can multiply a decision tree by a constant mod 2 pi. And you can evaluate, so every point in that space, every point in that space is a decision tree, and it becomes a vector space. And then you can evaluate the sharpness by the function I showed you, and it's essentially assessing whether that particular policy gives you a sharp estimate of the phase or an unsharp one. So without a training set, you have to come up with another way of deciding whether a policy is good or not. So the sharpness of the policy is what we use to determine if it's good. Okay. Some people might be worried here correctly that, of course, what we want is accuracy and this is precision, but then we check whether a criterion based on precision also gives accuracy, and then in our simulations it seems to. Okay, so that I've set the stage for, yeah. Yeah, so Josh saying if the estimate is unbiased, then the precise estimate will be accurate. Correct. Yeah, that's the hope. Okay, so here I've just set the stage where I've shown you how to convert this into a search problem where policies make a vector space. Now I want to go to the other problem that we've been focused on. This is the one motivated by Martinez Group experiments at Santa Barbara on controlled Z-gate. So here, there was a show of hands earlier on, I think Maria asked it, how many know quantum information. I didn't see so many hands go up, but I think, I'm hoping people know what these gates are. So we have single 2-qubit, 3-qubit gates, and I'll talk about the Martinez Group 2-qubit gate, and then I'll talk about how to make a 3-qubit gate, and our goal is to devise a control scheme so that we can design a procedure that will realize a 3-qubit gate with the same fidelity as their 2-qubit gate in the same time. So it's a highly constrained problem. We want to see if it's possible to make 3-qubit gates as good as the 2-qubit gates through a single-shot control procedure with the same fidelity. So it's a very ambitious concept. Okay, let me explain how the Martinez approach works. They have two transmons. The transmon is an infinite level system, which we can truncate to four levels with a high degree of accuracy. The qubit, which is, so the logical space only sits in the two lowest levels, and you can think of a qubit frequency delta one and delta two, and then the other levels can be described by an anharmonic oscillator. Eta is the term of anharmonicity, and that's fixed. So you can tune your deltas, and you know your eta from the experimental conditions of how the transmon is made. Then they want a gate, which is xx plus yy, if you work in the qubit space, but if you take into account the capacitive coupling between two transmons, you could just write your x as a 4x4 matrix of that type, the y of that type, and then the interaction term is written in that form. Then, when you do it, you can write down the Hamiltonian for the system, and you want to make a controlled Z gate, and the truth table for the controlled Z gate looks like this. So input 0, 0, no change, etc. But if both are 1, then you get a sign change. And the way that they do it is you can diagonalize your Hamiltonian. You can diagonalize your Hamiltonian. Actually, this is where I really need to point. No. Okay, maybe the mouse will work. Okay, I could use the mouse, it's okay. So the key point here is when you diagonalize it and you consider controlling the frequency of one qubit relative to the other, you can send in a pulse, you see this? So you send in a pulse that tunes one qubit relative to the other. It hangs around there for a while and then it goes back slowly. And the idea is to bring these two levels very close, your 1-1 and your 2-0, and nothing else is close. And by doing that, you can affect a sign change on the 1-1 and nothing else. Okay? So the idea here is that you're able to do this routine where you just steer through space to an avoided crossing and avoid any other avoided crossing. So now, if we consider generalizing to 3 qubits, we have 3 4 level systems here. And let's consider a controlled Z gate. So we only want to change the sign of the last one. What we really want to do is to change at least two of the frequencies. I've projected down into one. These crossings indicate that we've projected to too small a dimension. So what we want is we would have delta two, say in delta one, and then what we have to do is to you have to kind of drive into a region where you have one avoided crossing, but never hit any others. So can you see this as a pathfinding problem? You have a higher dimensional space, and then you want to steer your agent so it will get close to the avoided crossing that will change that sign and nothing else. So then that becomes amenable to search. It's a search problem in a high dimensional space. So then it's very amenable to reinforcement learning concepts. So that's the goal. And then the way that that one is formulated mathematically is we simply take the Hamiltonian. We have delta of t is just the tuning control over each of the qubits. We have a drift term and a control term. And here, we have L control parameters, so how many qubits have a controllable frequency. And the drift term is what we don't control. It's built in the system. And then we have the resultant unitary evolution, and we characterize the fitness by the trace fidelity of the desired gate, control Z, daggered, with the actual unitary evolution. And in fact, we don't even make it unitary later. We put noise in and everything. So the idea here is we now have our objective function, and that way we can do reinforcement learning with a punishment reward system. So as I said before, with the quantum metrology, the punishment reward was based on whether the estimate of the phase was sharper or less sharp. In this case, it's based on whether the fidelity of a particular policy that determines how these control parameters are chosen, whether that policy becomes, whether it delivers a better fidelity or not, you see. So in every reinforcement learning approach, you always have to have reward and punishment in the system. Okay, so now I think I lost my timekeeper. okay, so Josh left, so I think I'm unlimited in how long I can go on. We'll be here a long time. So in making decisions about what kind of routine to use, we start to figure out what's going on in the problem. So we look at the search space dimension, which I wrote as capital D here. The number of constraints I've written as capital epsilon. And then we also start to think about how many agents we need in the space based on what little we know about the landscape we're searching. So in the case of adaptive phase estimation, we start to recognize our dimension. We're concerned with up to 100 photons going in. That was our target in being able to optimize the system. And our constraints, 2n plus 1, you can see that it's highly constrained. Our search space can be 100 dimensions, and our constraints is over 200 dimensions. That tells us that it's going to be likely to be a very terrible landscape. So the greedy algorithms that are so popular won't work. I was telling them, if you don't come back, I'm not going to stop. Yeah. Oh, this, I don't know this time. Oh, it's a tiny, yeah, it's the red faded. Plus 10% of all males are red-green colorblind, so they won't see anything. Okay, that's okay, thanks for trying. So, and then in the, in the case of the gate design, for the stuff we're looking at to make it competitive, you know, as I said, to do the Martinus-type gate with three transmons instead of two over the same time scale with 1 nanosecond steps with the same fidelity, we wind up dealing with a search in an 84-dimensional space, and the number of constraints is double that. So you see, typically we're working in systems where our constraints double the number of dimensions we're searching. So these all tell us reinforcement learning is a good way to go. And then the number of agents, we don't have a method for. We just try different number of agents and get a sense of what works. So far it's intuitive. We don't have a good way to get that right. Okay, then I promised you I'd talk something about the differential evolution approach. So there's a standard. We did a small modification that helped us a lot because we're going to higher dimension than what differential evolution works with. But I worked with my students to construct cartoons since when my students explain things to me, they have to put it in cartoons. I'm not smart enough for anything harder. So I'm going to share what they explained to me. Anyway, the idea is that we take our policy. I showed you how the policy can be written as a vector. So this is simply the vector representation of a policy. In differential evolution, we call that a chromosome. So in genetic algorithms, there were genes. These are chromosomes. And then I've just used monochromatic depictions of the initial points. So we have a set of agents in, for example, 50. So we have our 50 agents, and we make a set of all of those. Then what happens is we pick three of the agents, and then we do a mutation. Mu is the mutation rate. So we take two of them, do a subtraction of the values in those vectors, multiply it by a mutation factor, and add to the other vector, making full use of the vector space properties of policies. And then we get some hybrid. So it's the child of a three-party union. Then, once we do that, then we have a crossover rate where we take another one, mix with this offspring, and then with the mixing, we then obtain a new version. And then this scale represents weighing up which one is better relative to the fitness function. You know, it could be the sharpness of the phase estimate in the interferometer case, or it could be the fidelity of the gate for the transmons. And we just do this over and over again for some number of generations. G, which could be the tens of thousands, the routine is very quick, so we're not heavily constrained. Actually, I should be careful. Routine is quick. This is actually the time-consuming part, is evaluating. So most of it's quick. Evaluation is the slow part, and we're working on all kinds of ways to improve evaluation. What we did, that works on the order like 100 to 150 dimensions. We're up to 200 dimensions, as I showed you, or not sure I showed you, but that's where we're at now for the latest problems. So we just modified it in a technique we call SUSADE, which is subspace selective, I forgot what it stands for, subspace selective something something differential evolution. Oh, self-adaptive differential evolution. And in this case, we have a switch that we throw, and so sometimes instead of doing things over the full dimensional space, we randomly switch to go in a smaller space, in this case, one dimension. So the searching the large space is really bad, so sometimes we just go in a smaller space and then go back to the larger space. And by doing that, we've been able to work up at 200 dimensions with about 400 constraints. Okay, now after doing all that, using that differential evolution technique, these are the kinds of results we're getting. First I'll show you, and again, the purpose here is not to go into the details of these applications, but more to give you an idea of what reinforcement learning is about and why it's a big advantage in these systems. So in the adaptive phase estimation, what we do here is we look at the log of this Halevo variance. So you can think of it like the phase variance or how wide the phase uncertainty is. I mentioned before that the uncertainty, the delta phi, goes as the square root of number of particles in the classical case. It's linear in the number of particles in the quantum case. So what we find always is that it's a power law behavior. So the more quantum, the closer we are to linear, and the more classical, the closer we are to a square root. And in between, there's a power between a half and one. And then we just do a log-ln plot for a power law, so it should be a straight line. And then over here, this one you can see it's a, that's the Heisenberg limit. So that's the ideal slope. There's the standard quantum limit here. And then the actual results we get are quantum enhanced. So they're better than the classical behavior. We don't care about the intercept. So the fact that these cluster here doesn't matter. What matters is the slope. And you can see, I'm not sure it's visible, it's very small, but we talk about differential evolution, particle swarm optimization, hill climbing. We've done simplex and various techniques. So we modularize our programming so that we're able to do, we're able to test our stuff. Like instead of just running a particular routine, we test based on a whole stream. Like we think, what would everybody else do? And then we modularize it so we can plug it in and quickly get the best answers possible from each of the routines. And then in those cases where greedy algorithms fail, then we get excited and then we start to kick in our stuff. So with the differential evolution and the sigma and the eta terms, eta is a loss rate. So we're allowed to lose photons, and we also have noise on the interferometer. So we make things noisy. We have no model assumptions about it. And then we're getting very straight lines up to 100 photons and better than the standard quantum limit. So the idea of this curve is really to convey to you, 5 minutes, that including questions? Okay. So we have very straight lines and we're seeing quantum enhanced processes. So the message is that our technique is working well and greedy algorithms do not deliver anything up, say, beyond 20. Now, of course, anybody here is going to say, of course they do. You just need enough agents that all operate independently in greedy algorithms. So of course they will with unlimited computer power. When I say they don't work, it doesn't mean they can't work. You know, in a million years, we might have so many computers it would work. But when I say it doesn't work, I mean under any reasonable conditions. Whereas ours are working in, you know, maybe a month of supercomputer time or something. Okay, so that's the adaptive quantum metrology. Here's our kind of assessment of the control Z gate. These parameters that we plug in are comparable to the conditions in Martinez's group's experiments. And then we look at techniques like quasi-Newton, simplex, differential evolution, our subspace selective self-adaptive differential evolution. And then we assess what the best fidelity is. bearing in mind that we want to get a fidelity. Like, you know, you could say, well, Simplex gives a nice fidelity, it's 0.92, but that's not what the Martinez group got with their controlled Z gate. So we have, you know, based on those conditions, we're not able to, with any reasonable effort, get the greedy algorithms to deliver, and yet using our SUSAID technique, we're able to get 4.9 fidelity as the best case for our design. And then what that does, so essentially here's how it works, just to give you a picture. This is a pulse sequence at 1 nanosecond steps that would go over 26 nanoseconds, controlling 3 transmon qubits to deliver 4.9 fidelity without considering noise. So you can see delta 1, delta 2, delta 3. These shapes look funny. What happens is we, in experiments, the because of the electronic noise, the pulse shapes are not top hat functions. They look very close to Earth's error functions. So these are conjoined error functions through the control sequence. So our policy is a representation of the sequences of these 3 single qubit controls. We do, check it for different strengths. These are like Rabi frequencies. Check it for different Rabi frequencies and verify that we're getting a, you know, if you increase your Rabi frequency or your local coupling strength to your qubits, then you should get a faster performance of your gate, and we confirm that everything's consistent, it is. So we have kind of consistency checks. This F bar is an average fidelity where we take into account noise in the system. So we try to plug in all the bad things that happen in the transmon qubit system, and then we look at how the fidelity performs under our, we're trying to be as nasty as possible in our simulation to take into account realistic effects. And we're finding under our simulation of realistic effects, there's very good fidelity. I have, of course, asked for experiments to be done, and of course I've been told no. But you know, it's not for lack of trying. We would like to test all this. And then over here, this is simply telling you that under the differential evolution, we can then plug noise on. So this is fluctuations in the qubit frequencies, and we can get in megahertz under those conditions, and we can find that we get very robust performance for up to a certain noise level, and then it all breaks down. But the noise level where it breaks down is quite reasonable compared to experimental conditions. Final slide. So the summary is as follows. First of all, I've been trying to convince you that we have developed schemes of heuristic-based learning algorithms, and I should be clear, it's reinforcement learning, that we believe that they generate feasible policies. We put all this in the context of quantum channels. So I'm looking for practical applications like gate design and quantum metrology, but it's much more general. Anything where you want to control any quantum channel, it seems to work very well. As I said at the beginning, and I put the warning again, that if greedy algorithms like Grape or other techniques work, don't use our method. So if greedy algorithms work, they're going to be thousands or tens of thousands of times faster. But if they don't work, then call the doctor, and somebody in my group will come out and run a non-greedy reinforcement learning algorithm. So that's where we see ourselves stepping in, is when greedy algorithms start to break. We've shown this for the, what we've tried to make as reasonable as possible, the 3-qubit gate with linearly coupled transmons. We also have shown this for adaptive quantum metrology. It's a toy problem, but it demonstrates a lot. And we think it's quite versatile, and that the idea of using reinforcement learning for quantum control in general should prove to be a valuable technique as we push quantum technology further. Thanks.
All right, I might start with a question. So I guess you spoke about, in your plots, you're sort of showing that you see, based on these different kind of optimization techniques, improvement in precision. I think it was, this slide here. Have you also looked at the cost of these, the sort of computational cost of these various algorithms, and have some idea of what?
Yeah, I'm trying to make it very clear in the warning, and I'm glad you're giving me a chance to emphasize. The computational costs are high, but not prohibitive. So that's why I'm saying that if you use a greedy algorithm for control and it works, typically we find it'll be 10,000 times faster. But then the point I'm getting at is that in a lot of cases, you're very limited. If you want to get a high fidelity or a short time of operation, or you have certain steps, or you require error function, smooth out error functions connecting things. Once you start constraining your system, and if what we find as a rule of thumb is if the number of constraints is greater than the dimension of the search space, then they don't work. So if it works, our computational cost is very high. If greedy algorithms don't work, then there's no better alternative.
So just to clarify terminology, so what's the relationship between differential evolution and genetic algorithms? Because I only know genetic algorithms, and that seems to be that. Is that a subclass, or is that just a different name? Or
So genetic algorithms is the, I don't know, the earliest or one of the earliest of the evolutionary algorithms. So the, so if you've gone through genetic algorithms, you know how they work. This is a variant of a genetic algorithm, but it's an extremely powerful variant. What's happened in the physics community predominantly, people had bad experience with genetic algorithms, say 20 years ago. So most physicists, I find, have moved away. They kind of said, well, genetic algorithms weren't as good as these alternatives, and moved away. But in the machine learning community, particularly in the reinforcement learning, the work that goes on evolutionary algorithms is strong. There's a whole conference dedicated to evolutionary computation. So on some level, we're still, instead of genes, we're taking chromosomes. We're breeding them, weighing them up, and replacing. But the new techniques are so powerful that they overshadow all the techniques from 20 years ago. They're starting to put these in packages, but it's still not at, like, I know some people who are starting to use these and not getting great results, because it still takes some thinking to make the best use of them.
Would you expect some of the reinforcement learning techniques that you've talked about for control here to scale better for high-dimensional systems than greedy algorithms would?
So that's a key question. This goes back, again, I don't know if you have the background in quantum control, but you do. So Herschel rabbits, et cetera, and I've talked to him about this at least a couple of times now. We don't disagree on things. The argument he has, which I accept, is that if you go to high dimension, greedy algorithms get better and better. And the concept is that, intuitively you can see it because, if you increase dimension of your search space, but you fix the constraints, then the constraints become less important and the traps start to disappear. What I'm saying in here is, you can see here, the number of constraints is proportional to the number of dimensions. Same over here. So in the case where the number of dimensions grows and the number of constraints grows with the number of dimensions, then I think the answer is no. I expect greedy algorithms to fail.
Okay, thank you.
Hi. Over here. Can you clarify something? So I heard you say that your results were robust in the presence of noise. Obviously, this is all simulation. Have you ever contemplated doing training with noise?
Good question. Did you ask if I ever contemplated it?
Or did you ever do it or experiment with it?
Okay, so yes and no. Yes, we contemplated. No, we didn't do it. And we should do it. We haven't done it yet for two reasons. One is it's even more computationally expensive. And the second is we're a little bit nervous that the policy that we obtain could be very sensitive to assumptions in the noise model. So far we train, train under the noiseless conditions, and then we plug in our policy into the noisy case, check if it works. But your point, when you're seeing a breakdown after a certain amount of noise, that's the way to steer around, that would be the case. But it's on our list of things to do, and we haven't done it.
Thank you.
Do you know how your method compares with other non-local methods, such as maybe Q-learning or maybe simulated annealing, that I think could apply to this problem as well?
So we do test the control Z gate, for example, we do test that against simulated annealing. I didn't show the result. We test against genetic algorithms, but the better ones that I do show, it's like particle swarm optimization is stronger. We do ant colony and the bee. So we, but essentially, you know, we're running those. So as I said, we modularize, and then there are certain packages where you can, you know, on access free packages, things that you can access where you can test them. So we do that. We plug in each one we can get our hands on and test it. And then for, you know, when we do things like your question's good, and when we do things like, you know, this ESAN meeting, European Symposium on Artificial Neural Networks, that's the kind of question you're coming. That's the kind of thing we have to do if we're going to get into an artificial neural networks meeting. So we are running those, but not as extensively as we should.
I might ask one last question.
Chris has
It's Chris. Okay.
I'm okay with two last questions.
So you've discussed adaptivity a lot here in the context of a policy with a preset number of measurements. So I mean, maybe two kind of sub-questions of that. One is, if you commit to doing in and optimize a policy that way, you know, what does that then tell you if you want to do n plus one measurements or something other than, or you want to change the number of measurements dynamically, perhaps would be a better way to put it. And then how does this approach compare to other methods of adaptivity other than lookup tables?
So let's see if I get it. The first question, the first sub-question is this, like, there's kind of a standard debate in quantum control where you have your numerically minded people where I sit, and then the intuitively minded people. And the intuitively minded people lean towards saying, if you have an approach where if we tweak this, we can get something better. And the numerical people say, even if you tweak, everything changes dramatically. Is that kind of where you're coming from?
Not exactly. I mean, if I understand right, you have a decision tree, right? So that's a lookup table, specifically in the metrology case that you're talking about. You have a lookup table for what the phi m there should be at the mth step as a function of the data that you've observed. And I mean, it's a particular, it's a constrained lookup table according to this heuristic, but it's still like, once I hit the bottom of the tree, what should the next measurement be?
Sure, that's used in this setup here, okay? Yeah, but what you're calling the lookup table, that's the policy, is what we're trying to find.
But I mean, it's for a fixed number of measurements that you will ever do, right? I mean, if you've done that and decide you want one more measurement or however many more dynamically.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, I understand now. Yeah, so the point here I mentioned about benchmarking with this so-called sign state. So then you look for, like, you can consider different states. So it's actually crucial at this point that what it says is if you're going to, if you want to say given, you know, if I send in 100 photons, if I send 100 photons, and then will that be useful if I send in 101? It's kind of the flip side of the question that says, what if I design everything for 100 photons and one gets lost? So, you know, if I design my policy for 100 photons and only 99 get detected, did I learn anything? And that comes down to this problem, and it's one that we're working on in my group. It turns out this is an excellent state, the one from Summey and Pegg back in 1990, and it was used by Howard Wiseman a lot in his adaptive quantum metrology work. That by feeding in that state, then the question you're asking has a very good answer, that we learn a lot by going to the next number. But that should, of course, be obtained by some other optimization approach. So what I would rather do is take your question, turn it into a constraint, and then optimize under the constraint to be more rigorous. What was the second sub-question?
Well, I mean, by comparison, I don't necessarily have to do things as a decision tree if the heuristic is an online heuristic rather than a heuristic for how to generate the decision tree. That is, if you, it, like, I mean, it, there's a computational constraint that's implied on the processing unit that it should only be, you know, large enough to look up a decision tree.
So I don't understand what you mean, because like in this case, you don't know what to do. So we're using a reinforcement learning technique to train because there's no training set. I don't understand how you would train.
I mean, the adaptivity need not be something where you design every, it's a particular constraint that you've put to say that you want to know the entire adaptive tree before you do the first measurement. And I mean, that seems like a useful constraint because it allows for a very small processing unit. But I mean, how does it compare to relaxing that constraint and allowing the processing unit to make decisions online?
So because I've worked on this for 6 years, and then before that I spent 3 years in a total state of confusion, and I found that I had to learn machine learning to even get some clarity. So I'm having trouble with the question, and maybe we can talk about it offline, but the problem I ran into is I eventually found that I need to take the problem, formulate it in the machine learning context, identify whether it's supervised, unsupervised, reinforcement learning, et cetera, and then when I kind of work my way down. So I think I have to talk to you later to see even the way you're phrasing it, whether you're talking about a reinforcement learning strategy or some other learning, because I can't think about it until I can place it in the pantheon of machine learning types. So I'm not sure how to answer.
Okay, let's thank Barry.